Hi, I'm Matt Payne, and welcome to 20th Century Revolutions. Episode 2.8, Armenian Revolutionary Federation, the Armenian Resistance, Part 3. On Sunday, March 13th, 1881, Tsar Alexander II of Russia planned to spend his day as he had spent nearly every Sunday of his decades-long reign. The 62-year-old Tsar had made it a tradition to travel down to the center of St. Petersburg to lead a ceremonial roll call with his imperial troops. But before he made this fateful journey into the heart of the Russian imperial capital, Alexander II met with his interior minister, the Russian-Armenian Count Loris Melikov, to discuss a reform plan that the Armenian count had been working on over the past few months. Tsar Alexander II had long been known as a great reformer, and the Tsar had begun his nearly 30-year reign by announcing the greatest reform in Russian history, the emancipation of the serfs. And after freeing the serfs, the Tsar Liberator, as he thereafter came to be known, would introduce a whole host of other reforms meant to drag the Russian Empire out of its dark feudal past and into the modern age. But even with all of these reforms that were supposed to help everyday Russians, Alexander II's reign had still witnessed an increase in rebelliousness amongst his subjects, a rebelliousness that had quite often proven to be directly threatening to the Tsar's health and safety. On two different occasions, first in 1866 and then more recently in 1879, assassins had attempted to kill Tsar Alexander II. And even though the Tsar had managed to survive these two attacks, these assassination attempts had led the Tsar to become a bit less benevolent in his rule. But even so, Tsar Alexander II still tended to approach the issues facing his empire from a perspective of generally wanting to improve the lives of his subjects. And so in the face of increasing unrest within his empire, the Tsar had given the Armenian Loris Melikov the somewhat unenviable task of drawing up a reform plan that would both suppress revolutionary elements within the empire and also address the recurrent issues that had led these revolutionary elements to emerge in the first place. So, on that spring Sunday morning, the Tsar Liberator had assured his Armenian interior minister that his reform package would be officially signed off on later that week. But just 2 hours after their meeting, when the Tsar was performing his weekly military roll call in the streets of St. Petersburg, an assassin from the populist revolutionary organization, People's Will, hurled a bomb at the feet of Alexander II. And the third time would be the charm, as the wounds inflicted by this explosion would prove to be mortal wounds, and the Tsar Liberator died later that very same day. Sitting at his bedside as the Tsar breathed his last breath was the Emperor's son, the tall, broad-shouldered, and gruff 36-year-old Alexander III. And having just witnessed the assassination of his father at the hands of ungrateful terrorists who had continued to plot against the empire, even after they had implemented benevolent reforms meant to help the common people, the new Tsar would quickly turn away from his father's more liberal policies, and Alexander III would initiate an era of fierce reaction and repression. One of the first actions taken by Alexander III was to dismiss Count Loris Melikov from his post as interior minister. And in some important ways, this decision to sack the Armenian nobleman would prophesy the future direction of the Russian Empire under the leadership of the new Tsar. To begin with, as the author of the recently drafted reform package, Loris Melikov was very directly associated with Tsar Alexander II's liberal-ish style of rule, which Alexander III felt had only brought about chaos and directly resulted in his father's death. So, getting rid of Loris Melikov meant turning the empire away from reform. But then, possibly even more ominous, was the fact that the advisor who had told the new Tsar to dismiss Melikov, the fierce reactionary Papadonostev, had warned Alexander III that because Melikov was ethnically Armenian, he was, quote, not a true Russian. And indeed, Alexander III's ascension to the throne would be followed by a dramatic increase in the level of violence perpetrated against the empire's large population of ethnic minorities, most dramatically witnessed in the hundreds of anti-Jewish riots and pogroms that swept through the empire in direct reaction to the assassination of Tsar Alexander II. For the Armenians of the Russian Empire, the assassination of the Tsar Liberator and the ascension of the reactionary conservative Alexander III would be a major turning point. For many, many years, the Armenian community of the Russian Empire had professed a fierce loyalty to the Russian Tsar, and Armenians had risen to the highest levels of imperial government, as seen in the appointment of Count Laris Melikov to the post of interior minister. But all of this would quickly change under Alexander III, as the new Tsar inherently mistrusted anyone who was not a true Russian. So the Tsar would purge his government of non-Russian officials and aggressively begin to implement a policy that would come to be called Russification. Russification was essentially the process of forcibly assimilating the minorities of the Russian Empire through such tactics as exclusively teaching Russian in schools and just generally discriminating against Christian denominations that deviated from Russian Orthodoxy. Russification would be devastating for the Armenians of Russia. Over the past few decades, the Armenian community in the city of Tiflis, that vibrant center of Armenian life in the Caucasus on the southeastern border of the Russian Empire, had opened many Western-facing schools originally with the blessing of the imperial government, as the Tsar Liberator had maintained a fairly magnanimous relationship with the Armenians of his empire. These schools in Tiflis not only encouraged liberal Enlightenment values, but also fostered a sense of pride amongst their students in their unique Armenian heritage, culture, and language. And in the latter half of the 19th century, these schools in Tiflis had given birth to a new generation of Russian Armenians who held a more liberal, secular, and nationalist point of view. And this new generation would create somewhat of a cultural renaissance within the Armenian community as new artists, musicians, and most especially writers began to redefine what it meant to be an Armenian. One of the most influential writers within this national revival was the novelist known as Rafi, whose works of historical fiction often portrayed Armenian protagonists as they traveled through Russian, Persian, and Ottoman lands. And as a very popular author, Rafi's stories began to create an imagined community stretching across all of historic Armenia. And Armenians in Russia began to feel more of an affinity for their compatriots living across the border in the Ottoman Empire, as they read about Rafi's characters who navigated the Ottoman borderlands of eastern Anatolia with Kurdish bandits, corrupt Turkish officials, and even Armenian freedom fighters. And even though such stories had nationalistic and even at times revolutionary themes, they passed the censors in Russia. And this is mainly because the burgeoning nationalism amongst Russian Armenians for the most part looked towards the Tsar Liberator as a benevolent father who had the power to potentially liberate fellow countrymen living under Ottoman rule, just as he had liberated the Christians of the Balkans in the 1877-78 Russo-Turkish War. But with the assassination of Tsar Alexander II and the ascension of Alexander III, this fatherly benevolence would rapidly transform into despotic repression. Because with the onset of Russification, these liberal Armenian schools that had given birth to Rafi and his generation began to be viewed with suspicion, and the Armenian nationalism taught in these schools was now seen as a dangerous foreign element. So, in 1885, as part of aggressive Russification, the imperial government closed down all Armenian parish schools in the Caucasus and replaced them with Russian schools. What this meant in practice was that 500 schools with 20,000 students and 900 teachers were now suddenly set adrift. And almost immediately after the closure of these schools, Armenian teachers and students began to organize secret schools. And now feeling that their way of life was imminently under threat, the education at these new secret schools would be even more nationalist and even more strongly oriented towards instilling a sense of pride in being Armenian. The closure of the parish schools would have a galvanizing effect on the Armenian community in Tiflis and beyond, as Armenian leaders began to view the Russian state as hostile and repressive rather than benevolent and protective. And many of the students who had lived through this experience of seeing their beloved teachers getting fired and then being forced to hide their Armenian language and culture, well, they will become increasingly radicalized in the coming years. What this all meant is that going into the 1890s, many Armenians were turning away from the pro-Russian liberalism that had defined the 1870s and early 1880s, as more and more Armenians began to join the radical revolutionary underground of Russia. And so now let's talk about that revolutionary underground, because these young Armenian radicals are not about to be starting things up from scratch, but would instead be joining a revolutionary scene in Russia that was already very robust. I mean, the Tsar had literally just been killed by a bunch of radical populists. So, yeah, there's a scene. And many of the future leaders of the Armenian revolutionary parties will come out of this Russian underground, and their political programs will be shaped in some pretty major ways by the ongoing debates within Russian radical circles. So, what I want to do now is follow a few of these Armenian radicals as they journey through the Russian underground. And my hope is that in telling the story of radical Russian Armenians, we will not only offer a somewhat different perspective on the development of radical politics in the Russian Empire, but we will also gain an understanding of where all of these ideas are coming from once Armenian radicals begin to turn their attention to the plight of their fellow Armenians living under Ottoman rule in eastern Anatolia. And for you Mike Duncan fans out there, hiya Martians, as a point of reference, we are roughly going to be running parallel to Season 10, Episodes 14 through 17 or so, which cover this early revolutionary scene in Russia. So, first up on our who's who of Armenian radicals is Christopher Mikhailian, the future founder of the Armenian Revolutionary Federation, a party that will, after many twists and turns, go on to declare the First Armenian Republic in 1918 in the chaos following World War I. Christopher Mikhailian was born in 1859 in a small Armenian town in the southern Caucasus region of the Russian Empire. And at the very young age of 10, both of Mikhailian's parents would tragically die. And now an orphan, Mikhailian was enrolled in a boarding school in the nearby city of Tiflis, where he was trained to become a teacher. And upon graduating, Mikhailian would continue to live in Tiflis, working as a teacher within one of those liberal Armenian schools we just mentioned. But in addition to his day job as a teacher, Mikhailian also became involved in volunteer work that would begin to radicalize him at a young age. Specifically, Mikhailian began to work with Armenian migrant workers who had crossed the border into Russia from the Ottoman Empire, teaching them how to read and write and training them in the use of firearms. Firearms that they could then smuggle back home and use to protect themselves against Kurdish bandits. But just as Mikhailian was settling into his life as an educator by day and labor activist by night, the closure of the Armenian schools was announced in 1885 as part of the new Tsar's program of aggressive Russification. Like many Armenians, Mikhailian was outraged by this decision to close the Armenian schools, and he and a few of his fellow teachers distributed pamphlets that fiercely denounced the newly anointed Tsar. But seeing as he was now out of a job, Mikhailian had to leave Tiflis, and he would go and try his luck in Moscow. Upon his arrival in Moscow, Mikhailian was quickly swept up in radical politics as he joined the revolutionary socialist organization, People's Will. Now, at this point in the mid-1880s, People's Will was going through a bit of an existential crisis. Because for years, the party's entire ideological foundation had been built upon the idea that if someone could just figure out how to kill the Tsar, then the radical potential of the peasants would be awakened and a new society based on the principles of agrarian socialism would suddenly spring to life. And then People's Will miraculously succeeded in their primary goal as they assassinated the Tsar in March of 1881. But the death of the Tsar Liberator had not brought about a new age of agrarian socialism, but instead had led to an era of fierce reaction. And more specifically, the assassination led to the arrest, exile, and/or execution of nearly all of the most prominent members of People's Will. So, when Mikhailin joined People's Will, he was joining a party in the twilight of its life. But as People's Will was slowly unraveling in the 1880s, there were some fierce debates happening within revolutionary circles that would go on to be very important, not only for Russian radical politics, but also for the future direction of radical politics more generally. So, for some context, People's Will had originally been founded as a splinter group from the old Land and Liberty Party, which had been the center of gravity within the Russian Narodist or Narodnik movement of the 1860s and 1870s. And we've actually already discussed the Narodists when we covered Bulgarian liberation, because both Hristo Botev and Lubin Karavelov, future leaders of the Bulgarian Revolutionary Central Committee, had been part of this Narodist scene as young men studying abroad in Russia. And the Narodist brand of agrarian socialism, in which the peasant commune was meant to serve as the basis of a future classless society, would be very influential in shaping the politics of Hristo Botev in particular. And well, after these Bulgarian radicals, Botev and Karavelov, had moved to Bucharest, the Russian Narodists of the Land and Liberty Party had split into two competing factions, each pushing their own vision for how best to achieve this future classless society based on the peasant commune. This split amongst the Narodists really came to a head in 1874, after the debacle that would come to be called the Going to the People campaign, in which thousands of urban, affluent, and very idealistic student radicals traveled into the Russian countryside with the goal of essentially trying to convince the peasants to sign on to their revolutionary program. And well, Going to the People did not go very well, and instead of forming the core of a revolutionary army, the peasants mostly asked the local authorities if they could please promptly arrest all of these weird city folk spouting heretical nonsense. And while many of these students would simply go back to just being students after the failures of Going to the People, many others continued to push for agrarian socialism. But these radicals now had to face the reality that the peasants were not going to just magically become revolutionaries after hearing about this new, cool idea called Narodism. And so, in the wake of the epic fail that was Going to the People, a new debate would open up in the radical scene of Russia that mainly centered around revolutionary tactics. At this point, pretty much everyone wanted to achieve agrarian socialism, but some felt that the best way to get there was to slowly educate the peasants, and then over time, and with enough patient indoctrination, the peasants would be ready to launch their own revolution to overthrow the Tsar on their own terms. Others disagreed, because after the train wreck that was Going to the People, many Narodists now felt that educating the peasants was a hopeless endeavor, and those who felt that education just wasn't going to cut it began to turn towards terrorism as an alternative tactic. Essentially, it came to be believed that through a campaign of relentless assassinations, bombings, and political kidnappings, a revolutionary vanguard might be able to weaken the state to such an extent that would eventually just wither away, leaving the peasants free to continue living their lives in their agrarian communes without any need for an imperial government. This idea was very attractive to many Narodists because, well, it didn't require the peasants to be involved. Instead of having to spend years of their lives educating peasants who were unwilling to learn, young radicals could form a revolutionary vanguard and overthrow the Tsar and his government on behalf of the peasants. So, in the late 1870s, this debate over the question of quick terrorism versus slow education would split the Land and Liberty Party of the Narodists right in half. In 1879, the anti-terrorism faction, arguing for a continued campaign of educating the peasants, would form a group called Black Repartition, and this group would be led by Georgi Plahanov, the great socialist theorist who would one day be dubbed the father of Russian Marxism. And then the pro-terrorism faction, who felt that spectacular acts of violence against the state were actually much more likely to rouse the people from their ignorant stupor than education, would form People's Will. And at the time of the split, a lot of Narodists would throw their support behind People's Will, specifically because of the recent failures of going to the people. And right away, People's Will proved themselves to be extremely effective at perpetrating acts of terrorism against the Russian imperial state. But when they finally succeeded in their most spectacular act of all, the assassination of Tsar Alexander II, nothing happened. So the debate concerning the effectiveness of terrorism was reopened within People's Will itself. During his time in Moscow, Christopher Mikhailian would join the revolutionaries of People's Will in debating whether terrorism was actually effective in furthering the revolutionary cause. And Mikhailian's time spent in Moscow as a member of People's Will would leave an indelible mark on his future political program. And in time, Mikhailian would come down on the terrorism question a convinced, yes, terrorism is effective and we should do it. And Mikhailian would develop a strong belief in the power of what Mikhailian's idol, Russian anarchist Mikhail Bakunin, had once called the propaganda of the deed. But in the late 1880s, more and more of the members of People's Will were being arrested and sent off to Siberia. So by 1887, the party was essentially kaput. Now, the party's most prominent leaders would spend the next decade or so in exile until they would return home to form the core of the Socialist Revolutionary Party. But many of the Armenian members of the now defunct People's Will would leave Moscow and return home to the Caucasus. And these Armenian Narodists began to congregate in that great incubator of Armenian revolutionary politics, Tiflis. Christopher Mikhailian would himself drop out of his university program in Moscow in 1887, the very same year that People's Will was officially dissolved, and he would return to Tiflis with the very specific intention of carrying on the revolutionary struggle in the Caucasus. Once back home in Tiflis, Mikhailian joined up with a few of his old Armenian comrades from People's Will, and in 1889 they formed a group called Young Armenia. The specific goals of Young Armenia nicely demonstrate how Armenian revolutionaries were beginning to shift their focus now that People's Will had been crushed. More specifically, Armenian radicals began to turn away from Russian politics and to turn towards Ottoman politics. Because the primary objective of Young Armenia was to gather weapons, recruit people who could use those weapons, and then to send those weapons and people across the border into the Ottoman Empire in order to attack Kurdish tribes who had committed atrocities against the defenseless Armenians of eastern Anatolia. These stated goals of Young Armenia reflect two things. First is Mikhailian's own continuing belief in the propaganda of the deed, because he and his comrades hoped that these attacks on Kurdish tribes would galvanize the Armenian peasantry and attract the attention of the Western great powers, inspiring both the peasants and the great powers to take decisive action to defend the lives and property of Ottoman Armenians. And then second, these objectives reflected this growing interest of Russian Armenian radicals in the fate of their countrymen living under Ottoman rule. Now, Armenians from the Russian Empire had long taken an interest in eastern Anatolia, but this interest had for a long time been limited to the novels of Rafi, who used eastern Anatolia as the wild and exciting backdrop for his tales of adventure, romance, and tragedy. But as the revolutionary underground inside of Russia began to get ruthlessly crushed by the Okhrana, the Tsar's new secret police, Armenian radicals increasingly began to look towards eastern Anatolia not only as the setting of Rafi's novels, but also as an area in which they might be able to carry out their revolutionary dreams by providing real material help for the Armenians of the Ottoman Empire. As we talked about last week, the condition for Armenians living in the Ottoman Empire was becoming ever more desperate, with the now uncontrollable robbing and pillaging of Kurdish bandits and the Hamidiye cavalry regiments. And since Armenians in the Russian Empire were also now facing increased persecution under the Tsar's reactionary program of Russification, Christopher Mikhaylian would have a good amount of success in recruiting members into Young Armenia, and the group would come to include activists not only in the Russian Caucasus, but also across the border in the Ottoman and Persian empires as well. So by 1890, Mikhaylian had a little operation up and running in which members of Young Armenia would smuggle arms and revolutionary fighters across the Persian and Russian borders into eastern Anatolia. And these fighters would launch small guerrilla attacks, usually against Kurdish bandits, who were targeted for their crimes against Armenian civilians. But even though Young Armenia was beginning to gain some momentum, Mikhaylian had come to believe that a more coordinated effort was needed to truly bring about change in eastern Anatolia. Because at this point, Young Armenia was just one small group amongst many other small groups of Armenian activists, all working separately to improve the lives of the people in eastern Anatolia. So in 1890, Mikhaylian and some of his comrades from Young Armenia began the process of organizing a federated party meant to bring together all of the disparate revolutionary organizations scattered throughout the Armenian revolutionary underground. And this effort to join together all of the different Armenian committees would eventually give birth to the Armenian Revolutionary Federation. And over time, this group would come to be referred to as the Dashnak Sutyen, or simply the Dashnak, which in Armenian just means the Federation. Over the following decades, the Dashnaks will eventually emerge as the most important Armenian revolutionary party. But when Mikhaylian and his comrades were first putting together this federation, they intentionally tried to create a big tent that could house Armenian activists from across the political spectrum, including not only revolutionary agrarian socialists, like themselves, but also the moderate liberals of Tiflis, whose primary goal was usually to promote education and economic development. And many of these liberals were well-to-do businessmen, town leaders, and affluent students. So, you know, not socialists. By inviting people across the political spectrum into this new federation, Mikhaylian was beginning the work of putting together a broad nationalist party committed to the betterment of all Armenians, regardless of their class, place of origin, or religious or political affiliations. That being said, though, Mikhaylian and his friends were the ones putting the party together, and they were socialists. So even though they would keep things nice and vague at the beginning, the party would always have a certain socialist bent, and this uneasy and unclear relationship with socialism would create friction early on. The question of whether the Armenian Revolutionary Federation was going to be a specifically socialist enterprise or not was put up for debate almost immediately. Because while the party was initially being formed, Mikhaylian would try very hard to gain the approval of a group of emigre revolutionaries based in Geneva, who by that time were already running a fairly successful Armenian socialist party. And these were the Hunchaks. So let's introduce the Hunchaks, because they are the last of our big three Armenian revolutionary parties, sitting alongside the Dashnak Federation in Tiflis and the Armenikans of Van, who we talked about last week. The Social Democratic Hunchakian Revolutionary Party, or the Hunchaks for short, actually predate Mikhaylian's Dashnak and Young Armenia groups by a few years. The party was founded in 1887 by a group of Armenian students, all of whom had been enrolled at universities in Western Europe, and all of whom were Marxists. And even though Marxism will obviously play a very important role in the future history of Russia, at this time in the 1880s, Marxism amongst Russians was still the purview of a very small group of intellectuals. In its early days, the two primary figures who would bring the Hunchak party together were Mariam Vardanian, better known as Maro, and her fiancé, Avidis Nazarbekian. Both Maro and Avidis grew up in wealthy Armenian families from, yep, you guessed it, Tiflis, and both attended liberal Armenian schools before moving off to St. Petersburg to continue their studies. When Maro arrived in the Russian imperial capital, she very quickly immersed herself in the radical underground. And because of her interest in revolutionary politics, she would have to drop out of university and move to Paris in order to avoid possible arrests. And then a few years later, Avidis would himself also move to Paris after completing his degree. And it was in Paris that the two would meet and quickly fall in love. During their courtship, Maro would initiate Avidis into the revolutionary world of Paris, and the two lovebirds put together a small reading group with a few other like-minded Armenian students. Then, Avidis, Maro, and their friends began to hear about some exciting things happening over in Geneva, Switzerland. Specifically, they became interested in the small group of Marxist revolutionary theorists calling themselves the Emancipation of Labor Group. And this group in Geneva was led by none other than Georgi Plahanov, former leader of Black Repartition, who had then been trying to get everyone to please cool it with the terrorist stuff and to continue educating the peasants. Well, since his days as a young Narodist, Georgi Plahanov had developed in his political thinking quite a bit. Specifically, he had gone from being an agrarian socialist, like pretty much every other radical in Russia, to being a full-throated Marxist. After committing 3 years of his life to reading political economy, Plahanov had come to the conclusion that Marx and Engels had unlocked the key to history. And in 1883, Plahanov would, along with a few other Russian exiles, form the Emancipation of Labor Group in Geneva. And this group gets to go down as the very first Russian Marxist group. And in the coming years, it would attract the likes of Vladimir Lenin, Julius Martov, and Leon Trotsky as young disciples. But nearly a decade before Lenin would make his pilgrimage to meet Plahanov and company, the young Armenian radicals, Maro and Avidis, would travel to Geneva to learn from these early Russian Marxists. While living in Geneva, Maro, Avidis, and their Armenian comrades spent most of their time studying political economy, history, and philosophy, and writing about all they were learning in secret academic journals. And these Armenian Marxists would become regular contributors to the Armenikon journal we mentioned last week called Armenia. But when Maro and Avidis approached Mekirtich Portukalian, that exiled teacher from Van who ran the Armenia journal, about helping them to start a political party centered in Geneva, they were frustrated by Portukalian's lack of enthusiasm. So these young Marxist students decided to found their own party, and in 1886, they wrote to a group of Armenian monks in Vienna to see about acquiring their very own printing press. They threw together a party platform, and they gave birth to the Hunchakian Revolutionary Party. Being inspired by Georgi Plahanov, father of Russian Marxism, and coming out of the Armenian nationalist circles of Tiflis, the Hunchaks professed a very unique brand of revolutionary socialism. As Armenian Marxists, the Hunchaks would strike an uneasy balance between Armenian nationalism and Marxist proletarian socialism, which was an international ideology that viewed nationalism as generally harmful to class solidarity. Think workers of the world unite. So the Hunchaks had as their immediate goal the achievement of political independence for the Armenians living in eastern Anatolia under Ottoman rule. Like Mikhailian's young Armenia, the Hunchaks saw the plight of Ottoman Armenians as uniquely terrible and in need of immediate attention. But the Hunchak program did not stop with the liberation of Armenians in eastern Anatolia, as the Hunchaks planned to build on their victory in Ottoman lands to launch further revolutions in Persia and Russia, with the ultimate goal of establishing an independent, federated, socialist republic that would include all three of the historic Armenias, stretching across the borderlands of the Ottoman, Russian, and Persian empires. But being good Marxists, their program did not stop there, and the emancipation of Armenia was simply seen as the first step in liberating all the oppressed peoples of the world in an effort to bring about world socialism. With these modest goals in mind, the Hunchaks got to work on step one, liberate Eastern Anatolia. In their effort to achieve this goal, the Hunchaks would bring together a real grab bag of revolutionary strategies. To begin with, they would print pamphlets and manifestos to be distributed amongst the people of the Ottoman Empire, beginning in Constantinople and then spreading into eastern Anatolia. And it should be noted here that while the Hunchaks were definitely an Armenian nationalist party, they printed pamphlets in Turkish as well as Armenian, and they would direct propaganda towards both Christian and Muslim workers and peasants. And while they had very little success in bringing Muslims over to their cause, these efforts reflect the Marxist bent of the Hunchaks, because at least in theory, they had in mind the larger goal of creating class solidarity across religious and ethnic divides. Then, along with Marxist-style agitation amongst workers and peasants, the Hunchaks also bore the indelible stamp of people's will. And even though neither Avitus nor Mauro were, to my knowledge, ever members of People's Will, the Hunchaks would, much like Christopher McCallion, initially come down as a yes on the terrorism question. Now, terrorism as a tactic will continue to be fiercely debated amongst the Hunchaks in the coming years. But in their founding documents, the Hunchaks declared themselves as in favor of the old propaganda of the deed. So, a lot of their early activities will bear the mark of people's will-style terrorism. But then, there's a third influence at play here, and this is really what makes the Armenian wing of Russian radicalism somewhat unique. The Hunchaks, just like McCallion and his Young Armenia group, were heavily inspired by Balkan revolutionaries. And of course, we know all about Balkan revolutionaries because we dedicated a mini-series to both the Greek Revolution and to Bulgarian liberation. And well, Armenians like Mauro, Avitus, and Christopher McCallion also knew this history quite well. And so the Hunchaks and the Dashnaks would be inspired by the Greek clefts like Theodoros Kolokotronis, as well as by Bulgarian revolutionaries like Vasilevsky and Hristo Botev. And for Armenian revolutionaries, the liberation of the Balkans was not ancient history, but current events. The Russo-Turkish War had ended less than 10 years before the founding of the Hunchak Party, so they were very aware of the fact that Bulgarian revolutionaries had organized small guerrilla bands, and that these guerrilla bands had successfully sparked an uprising that had then created the conditions that allowed for their country's liberation from direct Ottoman rule. Now, much like the terrorism question, the strategy of using small guerrilla uprisings to prompt great power intervention in the style of Balkan revolutionaries will also be very controversial in coming years. But it was very hard for Armenians to just ignore the success that both the Greeks and the Bulgarians had had in their strategy of using small guerrilla-style revolts. In the early years of the Hunchak Party, they would have a decent amount of success recruiting members within the Ottoman Empire itself, specifically in Constantinople. And in the summer of 1890, the Hunchaks managed to put together a small demonstration in the Armenian quarter of Kumkapu in the Ottoman imperial capital. This demonstration began when a Hunchak agent essentially interrupted a very large church service that was being given by the Armenian patriarch. So after suddenly cutting off the spiritual leader of all Armenians, this Hunchak agent began denouncing the Sultan and reading a list of demands for reforming the empire. And while most people at this church service thought that this guy was crazy and hurried home in fear for their lives, after the Hunchaks forced the patriarch to lead their demonstration, a small group of people did join the Hunchaks as they began to march towards Yildiz Palace to present their list of demands to the Sultan himself. But this procession made it all of like 100 feet before they were stopped by Ottoman police. And the subsequent standoff with the police led a small riot to break out that would result in the deaths of a handful of protesters, including many of the Hunchak agents, as well as in the deaths of a few Ottoman police officers. Now, the Kumkapu demonstration did not bring about any material change in imperial policy. But at least one contemporary observer remarked that this was the first time since the Ottomans originally conquered Constantinople in 1453 that a group of Christians had resisted Ottoman soldiers in the imperial capital. And while this claim is dubious at best and would be utterly impossible to actually prove, the Kumkapu demonstration was a symbolic moment for both Armenian revolutionaries, and the Ottoman authorities. Armenian revolutionaries, for their part, were pretty excited about the fact that they had just managed to get people in the imperial capital to stand up to the Ottomans. But this also really freaked out Sultan Abdul Hamid, and this riot in the Armenian district, coupled with the discovery of the Armenican papers we discussed last week, definitely influenced the Sultan's decision to create the Hamidiye regiments just a few months later. For Armenian radicals in Russia, the Kumkapu demonstration had proven that it was possible to get Armenians in the Ottoman Empire on board with their program. And the limited success of the Kumkapu demonstration was actually a major contributing factor in Christopher Mikhaylian's decision to try and form his Federation of Armenian Revolutionary Parties. So in 1890, shortly after the demonstration, Christopher Mikhaylian called together the different leaders of the many scattered Armenian organizations. And due to the recent successes of the Kumkapu demonstration, the Hunchaks were seen by Mikhaylian and his comrades as one of the most valuable groups to get on board with this new federation. So Mikhaylian bent over backwards during the party's founding to appeal to the Hunchaks and to assure them that the federation was going to be a socialist party and that the Hunchaks would be able to just keep doing their thing. It would just now be under the larger umbrella of the Dashnak Federation. But even though the Hunchak representative at the Congress would initially approve his party's union with the Dashnak Federation, the Hunchaks not present at the Congress would quickly become dissatisfied with this new arrangement. Mikhaylian had a very hard time getting things moving early on, and this is probably because he was trying to knit together such a diverse coalition of Armenian nationalists who all had competing agendas and contradicting ideologies. But the inability of Mikhaylian and the Dashnaks to move things along proved to be frustrating for the Hunchaks, who did not want to have to run all of their decisions by this inefficient central committee in Tiflis. And these frustrations were compounded when the Hunchaks found many of the Dashnak representatives to be condescending and unreceptive to their ideas. And then, when Mikhaylian finally did something of value and got a revolutionary journal up and running, Hunchak theorists found that this journal did not line up with the Hunchak party platform. Early on, Mikhaylian and his inner circle in Tiflis had to be very careful about what they said in their journal so as not to alienate any of their less radical members, and so they mostly avoided using that scary word, socialism. And seeing as the Hunchaks were a Marxist socialist organization, this did not sit well with their members. And so, in the summer of 1891, less than a year after the Federation had been formed, the Hunchaks officially seceded from the Armenian Revolutionary Federation. The departure of the Hunchaks would throw the Dashnaks into an acute state of crisis that the Federation very nearly did not survive. But Mikhaylian would finally get his act together, and he called for an official party congress in the spring of 1892. And somewhat ironically, seeing as the Hunchaks had just seceded from the party because it was insufficiently socialist, the new party platform decided upon at this 1892 Congress would be much more explicitly socialist. And even though the split between the Dashnak and Hunchak parties would be very important for the future of the Armenian Revolutionary Movement, their official platforms would end up having a lot in common. Like the Hunchaks, the Dashnaks had as their primary goal the liberation of Eastern Anatolia. And then the means by which they hoped to accomplish this goal also similarly included agitating amongst workers and peasants, committing acts of terrorism in order to galvanize the Armenian people and potentially bring about great power intervention, and forming guerrilla bands to fight against Kurdish bandits and Ottoman regular forces. But the key difference between the two parties moving forward will come down to what they each saw as the end goal of their respective revolutionary struggles. As we have said, the Hunchaks wanted to form an independent federated republic that would include all three Armenias, Persian, Ottoman, and Russian. And the formation of this Armenian republic was seen as simply the first step towards achieving the larger goal of worldwide socialism. And well, at their party congress, the Dashnaks would put forth a much less lofty and probably a bit more realistic goal. The Dashnaks simply wanted to win reforms and achieve autonomy for the Armenians living in the six provinces of eastern Anatolia. So, unlike the Hunchaks, the Dashnaks would not list as one of their official goals the creation of an independent Armenia. But instead, they would seek to win autonomous rule for Armenians while still existing under the umbrella of the Ottoman Empire. The hope here being that autonomy could then allow Armenians to finally bring about real reform in eastern Anatolia. This split between those wanting an independent Armenia and those wanting an autonomous Armenia within the Ottoman imperial system will become critical in later years, especially as Armenian revolutionaries begin to join forces with the Young Turks in their effort to form a broad popular front in opposition to the Sultan. For young Turkish intellectuals, an independent Armenia was simply out of the question, while an autonomous or reformed Armenia, well, that would at least be taken up for consideration and debate. So, moving into the 1890s, the Armenian revolutionary movement will have two distinct wings, the Hunchaks and the Dashnaks. And then, of course, the Armenikans, but they'll just keep doing their thing down in Van. And as the Sultan's Hamidiye regiments continue to commit horrific atrocities against the Armenians of eastern Anatolia, the mission of the Armenian parties will become ever more urgent and dire. So, leading up to and following 1894, the year that will mark the beginning of the infamous Hamidian massacres, revolutionary agents from the Armenikans, the Dashnaks, and most especially in the early years, the Hunchaks, will make the long and treacherous journey into the wild borderlands of eastern Anatolia. And these revolutionaries will do everything they can to help defend the defenseless Armenian communities. So, join me next week as we trace the rise of the legendary volunteer freedom fighters of the Armenian resistance, the Fedayeen.